Welcome to this week's Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of December the 4th, 2017. I'm Ed Zollers, and after returning from a road trip that took me to Tulsa, Oklahoma, and Minneapolis, Minnesota, I'm now back here and going to talk to you about what's happened this week in the area of federal taxes, and it's been a busy week. If you're not aware, on Saturday morning, essentially, the United States Senate passed their version of H.R. 1. So they set up a conference committee. We'll talk a bit about what happened there at the end in the Senate and what we have going forward into a potential conference committee. We'll also talk about a case that came down this week where the IRS got access to information from a Bitcoin exchange that basically settles a situation that started about a year ago regarding what information the IRS could obtain from Coinbase. The tax court then went on and looked to use English law to determine if a payment stream was alimony for federal tax purposes. The IRS issued a safe harbor rule this week for casualty losses claimed from foundation damage that arises from pyrrhotite. We'll talk to you about the fact another taxpayer with an alimony situation was denied a deduction for legal fees to attempt to recover overpaid alimony. We have more relief for partnerships have been released by the IRS due to the change in the filing date we had for 2016 returns. And finally, we'll close out with the tax court updating its views on how you evaluate a stamps.com postmark when you're trying to deal with the timely filing rules. Well, let's begin with the biggest thing from this week, which, as you probably heard, was the United States Senate early on Saturday morning, I think it was 1:36 a.m., Saturday morning Eastern time, passed its version of H.R. 1, which is the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. And the Senate version was passed on a 51-49 vote. That was primarily a party line vote. The only person who basically switched sides, voted with the other party, was Republican Bob Corker, who voted against the program. But other than that, all other 51 Republicans voted for the program. All 48 Democrats voted against the program. But this passage sets up now both the House and Senate to pass the bill. The issue at this point is there are major differences in the two. So it's going to set up a conference committee. But what did the Senate do in the end? I mean, you know, how did they finally get the votes? Well, one thing, unfortunately, they did, it's something that I'd predicted early on. We talked about the original bill that came out of the House. The Senate, of course, to satisfy, you know, the complaints of various parties, needed money. And as I mentioned, we first talked about this bill, repeal of the AMT was something that basically cost a lot of money. Not surprisingly, the Senate put the AMT back in and their final bill. Now, if you have a larger exemption, you'll have a later phase out, and some of the things that cause you to be subject to AMT, like the deduction for state and local income taxes, no longer is there. But nevertheless, this particular add back ended up bringing them about $173 billion over 10 years, which allowed them to do certain other things. One thing they did do was they put back the $10,000 real estate tax deduction. That had been taken out of the House bill had added that in to satisfy those who were in high tax states, you know, especially, you know, Republican House members. They had made it very clear that this needed to be in the Senate bill or need to be in the final bill, at least, or they wasn't going to pass the House. Now the House has made, the Senate has made room for that. Well, another thing which they did do as well was they have now put back in for a couple of years the 7.5% of AGI limitation on medical deductions instead of 10% will go back to 7.5%, and it will not be an AMT preference. That's only for 2 years. And remember, the House bill got rid of medical deductions entirely, but that was also added at the end. We changed the pass-through deduction to 23%. It had been set at 17.4%. And we paid for that one by deciding to use the same rates as the House bill for the one-time onshoring, right, of offshore earnings and profits. The theory being of the senator who was pushing for this change was, well, we'd have to reconcile that anyway, so we might as well do it now and use the money. So they did. Now, of course, we're in a position where they have to reconcile the two bills. The House of Representatives actually called themselves back into session for Monday, specifically to appoint conferees. Presumably the Senate will do the same, and we'll get to work on a conference bill next week. What this means at this point is that Congress is still on schedule to produce this bill, you know, as, you know, by Christmas. So we may very well have before the end of the year these bill changes. Again, this can really have an impact on your year-end tax planning. So keep your eye on what goes on in Congress. And we'll try to keep our eye here on what's happening with Congress as far as these bills go. Now let's go on to our cases and rulings for the week. We're going to start here with a case that we first talked about last year when the IRS issued the subpoena, the United States versus Coinbase, Inc. This is from the United States District Court, the Northern District of California, case number 3:17CV0143. This opinion was issued on November the 29th. As you may recall that case, the IRS had originally requested quite a bit of information from Coinbase on all of their customers. Well, Coinbase filed an objection. I think most people thought that the IRS was not about to get everything on everybody that they had requested. And in the end, the IRS, 8 months in, changed their request. And what happened today was that we, or how it happened here on the 29th, was that the court finally ruled whether the IRS could obtain any of the information, and now the reduced information they had asked for 8 months in. And for the most part, the IRS was allowed most, but not all of what they requested on the second request. Now, the agency revised the request, so any account that has less than $20,000, you know, in essence, that did not have over $20,000 in any one transaction type, that's buy, sell, or receive during the year between 2013 to 2015, if you never went over 20 grand in any of those areas, you're exempted from this, as well as any customer that only purchased Bitcoin, or customers for which Coinbase had already issued a 1099-K. For their transactions. So those customers won't be there. So we're looking at people with $20,000 essentially in transactions other than just pure buys. And those taxpayers, you know, their information would go on to the IRS. Now, the IRS wanted a whole bunch of other information. They wanted to know Coinbase, know your customer due diligence information. They wanted their agreements granting a third-party access to any account, and they wanted correspondence between Coinbase and the customer. The court decided that particular information, while it might be relevant in a particular case, was not going to be granted carte blanche on a John Doe summons. The IRS had to come back in and show why they needed it for a particular customer. But they are going to grant for all customers who meet these requirements, that is, who have at least the equivalent of $20,000 in one transaction type, that is buy, sell, send, or receive, any 1 year from 2013 to 2015, the taxpayer ID number of the taxpayer, their name, birth date, address, records of account activity, which includes transaction logs or other records, and the types of transactions, right, their transaction balance, and the names of counterparties in the transactions, and all the periodic statements or invoices issued. So the IRS will get that information. That means that, in effect, if somebody had been kind of neglecting to report this particular information, might be a problem now. So again, the Coinbase situation appears to now be solved, at least for now. We don't know for sure. Coinbase has indicated they considered this a win. That suggests that they're not likely to appeal it. So we'll see what goes on, but it seems likely now that Coinbase, that information is going to be provided to the IRS. Next up, let's go to the case of Wallens versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2017-236, again issued on November the 27th. This was a case of a couple. This couple had been married in the United States, but their divorce took place in England. And the catch is often true, there's a series of payments in the document, but that series of payment does not say if the payment will end on the death of the payee. As you should recall, one of the key aspects for a payment stream to be considered alimony is that the payments cannot continue, have to cease immediately if the payee dies. The idea, I assume, went back to the point that if this was meant to support the payee, once the payee dies, there's really no support necessary. So basically, that would be the nature of alimony. And if that doesn't happen, then this looks more like property settlement if it's something that the heirs would get a right to. So the law simply requires you to show that. Now, when a document's silent, the tax court looks to the underlying, and the term that's been used in most of the cases is state law, applicable state law. Well, taxpayers in this case tried to argue a couple of things. Number one, they said, well, even though we might have had a divorce issued under English law, we were still domiciled in New York, so New York state law should determine whether or not we're considered to, you know, whether these payment streams end, at least the paying spouse claims that. The tax court said, no, it doesn't really matter where you live. It matters the law under which a divorce decree is granted. So the fact that you might be domiciled in New York is wonderful, but not relevant if you are granted a divorce by another jurisdiction. But they said, but hey, tax court, when you've done this before, and we've quoted a whole bunch of cases here, you always refer to applicable state law. And the last time I checked, England is not a state of the United States. Remember, there was that little war back in 1776, and we kind of broke away from them. Certainly doesn't seem like there's any relationship between England and the United States that would somehow make English law a state law for U.S. purposes. The tax court doesn't really go out and explain that, you know, why state law doesn't just mean states, but effectively says that they note that there have been prior cases where a divorce has been granted by a country other than the U.S., you know, outside the U.S., and we have gone ahead and used that country's law to determine if a payment stream was alimony. Because of that, the tax court holds, we're going to do it this time as well. Therefore, under English law, they determine this payment stream would not have stopped had the pay spouse died. So because of that, this payment stream is not alimony for federal income tax purposes. Next up, IRS Revenue Procedure 2017-60, issued on November the 24th of 2017. And this deals with the issue for safe harbor regarding a problem that's affected some individuals in the northeastern United States. It involves concrete foundations where the mineral pyrrhotite is involved in the concrete mix. That is a naturally occurring mineral that you'll find in a lot of concrete mixes. You know, that mix of all the stuff, all the gravel and stuff used in the concrete. It's naturally in there, but apparently in the Northeast, you know, its interaction there with the soil, the dampness, all that other neat stuff, has caused a number of foundations to crumble early. And specifically, this was investigated by the state of Connecticut, but it has impacts outside the state of Connecticut. So this particular ruling gives us some safe harbor rules to treat this damage as a casualty loss. Because as you might expect, that homeowners affected by this are going to incur some substantial expenses in order to basically get a foundation that's not falling apart. That's kind of helpful in your home. So because of this, we have these safe harbor rules. Now, number one most important thing about this is a taxpayer claiming under this revenue procedure will need an engineer's evaluation of the cause of the damage. They need to have the engineer say that pyrrhotite in the concrete was the reason why this damage has occurred to the foundation. And with that report, then taxpayers will be allowed to take a deduction for the cost they are having to incur to basically bring the foundation back up to standard. Now, as normal, the IRS warns you that you can't take a deduction for more than fair value. It's limited by all those bases, all these neat little things you got to worry about. But you still have the deduction. For most people, that limitation probably won't cause us a problem. If you fall under this, you can claim 75% of your costs as a deduction the year you pay them. If you're attempting to get reimbursement, but you've not yet been reimbursed. If you are not pursuing a claim for reimbursement, you can claim the full cost of that. Obviously, the 75% rule, this is something borrowed from the Madoff rule that we had many years ago, where there you got 75% if you're pursuing reimbursement. And then when it's finally determined if you'll get any or not, then you have to true up on that return. Same issue here. If you're not going for reimbursement, you claim the entire loss currently. Again, this affects those, especially in the Northeast. So if you have a taxpayer in the Northeast who's had this problem, take a look at Revenue Procedure 2017-60 for the rules for claiming this particular safe harbor casualty loss deduction. Next up, another alimony case. Well, kind of alimony case. It's a case of Berry versus Commissioner. The Berry case which is Task Court Memo 2017-23, was issued on November the 28th. And this interesting case comes from somebody who incurred legal fees related to alimony. However, he was attempting to get back alimony that he had previously paid to his ex-spouse. He claimed that the alimony previously paid to his ex-spouse was actually in excess of what their agreement had stated would be the maximum that she should be able to receive. So he was a paying attorney to go back out and try to get back that alimony. It turns out he had waited a bit too long to try this, so the case was dismissed, stating that if there had been any sort of valid claim in this area, you waited too long to file the case. So now he's simply trying to claim a deduction for his legal fees, which were over $25,000 relating to trying to get back his alimony. Now, as we're all probably aware, if you're trying to obtain alimony, right, fees to obtain alimony, then your legal fees are deductible. Regulation 1.262-1B7 specifically says that that's not considered a personal expense. Well, he's saying, well, look, I overpaid alimony. I previously deducted the alimony. Had it been paid back to me, I'd have to report that as income under the tax benefit rule. So actually, it's kind of like I was pursuing collection of alimony, right? Pursuing getting paid alimony. So shouldn't I get the same deduction? Well, the tax court said, look, this is normal. The origin of the claim test does apply here. And, you know, we have very clearly the origin of this claim. How you run the test for origin of the claim rule is you try to figure out, you know, would this case have occurred but for the personal marriage issue? And the answer there is pretty clear. If he had never been married to this person, the divorce proceeding would never have come. That divorce proceeding is what led to this issue. Therefore, by definition, that makes it personal. That said, there is that special rule in Regulation 1.262-1B7. One thing to note about this, that regulation is under the personal deduction, the personal loss, right? That we can't claim personal losses. This particular rule is a carve-out from that that specifically allowed a deduction not as a that would not be treated as a personal expense if you were paying to obtain alimony payments. Well, that's a specific exception. The court noted, Mr. Berry, we understand your idea, but here's the problem. General rule, alimony is personal, so the legal fees are non-deductible. And because you weren't trying to be paid alimony by your ex-wife, you were simply trying to get back alimony you had paid before, you don't meet the narrow requirements of this regulation. As such, Mr. Berry, there is no deduction allowed to you for this claim. So at the end of the day, you can't deduct the payment of the legal fees. Remember, the origin of the claim test is the key test for whether a taxpayer can deduct legal fees. And we're not looking at the result of the case. We're looking at the origin. That was the whole concept, because obviously the result in this case would have been taxable income. But we don't look to the result to determine if legal fees are deductible. We have to go back to see why did the claim arise. Did the claim arise out of a personal activity? Did the claim arise out of a business activity? In this case, because the claim arose out of the personal marriage, right, a very personal activity, the legal fees would be non-deductible, and we can't get them. Clients often have trouble with this because I don't know about your clients, but my clients tend to believe that every legal fee should be deductible. And as we know, that simply isn't the case. We have to find something that ties us back at the claim level, that ties us back to a tax-deductible transaction. You know, does it tie it back to a business transaction? Does it tie it back to some other sort of issue? You know, tax planning, those sorts of things that would allow us a current deduction. So, you know, care is always involved. And don't try to say, well, this is like, as the court pointed out here, because there's a specific carve-out in the regulation that says initially the payment is personal if it relates to alimony, period, you got to meet the narrow carve-out, and Mr. Berry did not. Next up, the IRS apparently got some complaints that their previous relief hadn't gone far enough. So in Notice 2017-71, the IRS granted additional relief to partnerships who may have run afoul of the fact that their tax returns were due 1 month earlier this year than they had been in prior years. Previously, we discussed the IRS's granting of relief in Notice 2017-47 for partnerships that had missed the March 15th filing deadline but had filed their return by April 15th. You know, saying that, well, you know, you filed what would have been timely, or they filed extensions by April 15th. That would have been timely in the past, but it's not timely this year because Congress moved the due date back 1 month. Remember, that was part of the Surface Transportation Act. They moved that back a month, and that was this year was when it took place. Well, that's fine. We no longer have the late filing penalty, but there are a bunch of other actions the taxpayers have to take that relate to the due date of the return. For instance, think about the fact that if they have a qualified retirement plan or a simplified employee pension plan, you have to fund it by the original or extended due date. So let's say a taxpayer had a profit-sharing contribution that was going in for the partnership. It was going in for both the partners and the partners and the employees of the partnership. And they made that contribution on April 10th because they've been used to being able to make it by April the 15th. And they file the return. Well, okay, now we know their return is not going to, they're not going to get hit with late filing penalties due to Notice 2017-47, but their plan contribution is still too late. Since it wasn't made by the due date of the return, the plan contribution would not be deductible on the 16 return, but you'd have to wait till 2017, assuming you were a cash basis taxpayer, in order to claim that contribution. Well, now we have this rule. The IRS did note it will treat other actions that are affected by the original extended due date as still being timely if you made them by the prior original due date or the prior extended due date, assuming you had tried for the extension. The IRS does warn, though, it does not affect the computation of interest because this affects not only the tax return for a partnership, but a number of other returns that may be due at the same time that were tied to the partnership due dates. And some of those would have had taxes due with them. You'll get out of being the fact you were late filed or the return was late, and the penalties won't apply, but you still would owe interest for that 1 month that it should have been paid. The idea the IRS always gives on that is that interest is something Congress has set by statute. They do not have the right to override that. So therefore, tough luck. You got to pay the interest. But all the other items are done. I think that'll be especially helpful for those people who had qualified retirement plans, because that was probably the scariest thing that most often would be tied to the original, to a timely filed return, that in this case, you hadn't done it by the time the return was due. Finally, we have a case here where the tax court says, yeah, we're going to follow what the Seventh Circuit said. We heard you guys when you reversed us on earlier case, and because of that, we now are going to treat this a little differently. This is the case of Pearson versus Commissioner 149 TC number 20. It was issued on November the 29th of this year. Now, the interesting aside was the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals had previously heard a virtually identical case on appeal from the tax court. And it was an identical fact pattern, and it was so identical that, in fact, the Tilden case, it was the same attorney and the same, basically, the same assistant, administrative assistant, who had supposedly mailed the returns on the same date. So it seems fairly likely that both tax court petitions were mailed at the same time by the same person. We have the same basic results here. The only difference is that the Pearson case, unlike the Tilden case, was going to be subject, if it was appealed, to the Eighth Circuit, not the Seventh. So what's the issue here? Well, the issue is that in this case, the attorney's office had applied a stamps.com label to the petition, to the envelope in which they had mailed the petition to the tax court to challenge the IRS's, you know, findings in the exam. They had mailed it 2 days before the due date, the last date for filing a tax court petition. Unfortunately, not that unusual. A lot of attorneys file that late in the system. You know, the idea being, well, if we can solve the problem otherwise, if we can get the IRS to withdraw the letter, if we can get the IRS to agree to a settlement without having to do the tax court filing, we don't do the filing. So 2 days before the due date, they applied the stamps.com label, and according to the assistant, she had taken it to the post office and put it in the postal system. Now, the catch was the IRS, or I should say the tax court, had previously found in a separate case, in another case earlier, which was Boltby versus Commissioner, which is in 2011, they had previously had a case where taxpayer had placed an item into the system. They didn't have a certified mailing date, but the they didn't have the receipt, I should say, but because they had sent it with tracing on, the U.S. Postal Service had a record of where it had been in the system, and that record showed the first date of the Postal Service records, which in this case actually, foreign postmark, I should say. So the first record coming into the United States Postal System was on the date, the last day for filing. And in Bolt v., the tax court had said, well, that first record by the U.S. Postal Service, that really was a postmark, a U.S. Postal Service postmark. And so because of that, we're going to hold this was timely filed, despite the IRS objection that they felt it shouldn't be timely filed. Well, the catch in this case comes, now we have the stamps.com label, except they had turned tracing on. And the first date this letter shows up in the U.S. Postal Service tracing database is the day after it would have had to have been mailed. So now we have a problem. Why? Because the regulations in question, when we look at the regulations under 6752, they tell us that if there is a U.S. Postal Service postmark, it takes precedence over a postmark applied by a party other than the United States Postal Service. So in this case, we have a postmark applied by a party other than the United States Postal Service, stamps.com, that shows 2 days before the filing deadline. And we have a postmark applied by the U.S. Postal Service, because we're saying that's the equivalent, that's 1 day after. Tax court in the Tilden case had ruled that this meant you were late filed because U.S. Postal Service postmark took precedence. The Seventh Circuit disagreed with that. They said, wait, that record in the Postal Service system is not a postmark. Therefore, instead, you have to go under the regulations that tell us that this is a postmark applied by other United States Postal Service. If you do that, and in the old days, this all dealt with postage meters. The tax court made clear that stamps.com labels are the equivalent of postage meters. Under that test, if you had that where you applied the postmark yourself instead of the Postal Service, is, you know, that date would be respected as long as it arrived at the tax court within the time frame that we would expect it to have arrived had it been mailed, you know, by you through the Postal Service at that date, or you have to show that there is a reason why it wasn't timely delivered. Well, that's more of a problem usually, but in any event, you know, that's how it goes. The tax court, they went back to the Postal Service, and the Postal Service said, well, it would have shown up in our database the day after it was mailed. So we don't believe it was actually mailed 2 days early, but we do believe it was mailed on the due date, on the date it had to be filed. So based on that, they said there's evidence it was presented. So again, with one other than U.S. Postal Service, you've got to have some evidence that you mailed it timely, and it has to arrive. It did arrive within the time frame they would expect it for this type of, for the distance involved for the mailing. So because of that, the court found that reversing its view in Tilden, that this was to be tested under the postmark applied by other than U.S. Postal Service. And so under that analysis, this was timely because there was no competing United States Postal Service postmark. Obviously, it would have been better for them to have gotten a United States Postal Service postmark and had the little white receipt that eliminates this case. But this does tell us how this works. Now, as I've said, it's always dangerous to use something like stamps.com or your postage meter for filing these documents. Maybe less so if you have tracing turned on, because in theory, if the Postal Service picks it up, and that is your big if it ever shows in the Postal Service mailing database, you have a big problem. But if it does show up in their database, then you might have a reason. You could show where it went, and that could help you prove why it was delivered late. But still, it's still risky to use this, but at least it does mean if you have the stamps.com label that you're not now at risk if it gets into the Postal Service system a day later than it should have, which is the argument of the attorney in this case. But yeah, this is one of those cases, nice to know, nice that it's here, but ultimately we'd like to avoid having to rely on a case like this. Well, and we're in December now. This is your last month before we head into the wonderful tax season, right? January comes and pieces start happening for tax season. So this is the time we're looking to get our CPE. This week, I'm going to be heading on to Albuquerque. I'm actually going to be doing a depreciation course on Thursday at their offices. And then Friday, I will be participating in the New Mexico Tax Conference. Jim Hamill was nice enough to come over here and participate in our conference here in Arizona. So I'm heading over to participate in their conference doing an S-Corp update late on Friday afternoon. Then also the following week, I'm going to have my last road trip before we get to all these fun times coming up at the end of the year. So I'll be in Boise, Idaho on the 11th and 12th to talk about advanced partnership issues, including audits and pass-through entities advance. Hey, we might have a tax bill by then, so maybe we'll know how pass-throughs are taxed under the new law by those dates, 11th and 12th. If nothing else, we got the new audit rules to talk about on Monday of that week. In the partnership, of course, going to spend a lot of time on the partnership audits in that one because, hey, we're now heading into the year where that starts taking effect, so we got to worry about how it's going to affect our clients. And then on the 14th and 15th of that week, I'll be in Miami, Florida. In Miami, I'll be doing a session the first day dealing with real estate partnerships. So we'll talk about partnerships, real estate, how that works. Some more partnership audit discussion, obviously, in that day. On Friday, we'll be talking about, on the 15th, current federal tax developments. If we have a new tax law, we are going through the new tax law on the 15th of December in Miami. And I'm also going to do current federal tax developments the 19th of December in Phoenix. Again, if we have a new tax law, I'm going through the new tax law in that session. So again, you know, kind of keep your eyes open for how that works. And after that, I'm done through the beginning of the year. So that's great. And hopefully you guys are going to have a fun holiday season after that. In any event, come back next week. We'll see what happens in the conference committee, assuming we have one. And will we have a conference bill? Maybe. And if we do, will we have something to talk about? Well, maybe we'll have a conference bill, maybe not. Again, you know, keep tuned for right now. They're staying on schedule. So if they stay on schedule, we're heading for a tax bill for your Christmas present. So be aware of that. Otherwise, be sure to join us back next week with current federal tax developments. Catch our updates during the week that we're going to post on the website, currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. I have a PDF with all this week's developments that's available on the webpage. You can get that there. Also, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to me, email them to me, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can also follow me on Twitter, @edzollers. So until next week, this is your weekly Current Federal Tax Developments.